I'm going to talk about the developmental impact of trauma and abuse as an example of a way to really look at integration of biological, behavioral, and ecological issues within education and psychology. So that's really my plan. I want to begin with a quote, and some of you who've heard me speak will have heard this before, but again, it's still the best illustration that I know of the meaning of trauma. And this is the first paragraph from an autobiographical book by Richard Rhodes. Now, I need to tell you, Mr. Rhodes, if you haven't heard of him, is a prolific author. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has written on a number of different subjects. This was his first attempt at autobiography. And he actually experienced a series of traumas and losses in his life, beginning with the death of his mother when he was very young. And this is the way he describes that incident. When I was 13 months old, my mother killed herself. So eventually I learned, as I learned her maiden name, Georgia Sophronia Collier, and where she was born, Sulphur Springs, Arkansas, and how old she was when she ended her life, 29. And good Lord, writing these words now, all these years afterwards, for the first time in memory, my eyes have filled with tears of mourning for her. What impenetrable vessel preserved them? I didn't know my mother, except as infants know. At the beginning of my life, the world acquired a whole. And that's what I knew, that there was a hole in the world. For me, there still is. It's a singularity. And in and out of that hole, anything goes. Anything goes. I'd propose to you that trauma, particularly when it occurs during childhood, creates a hole in the world for the individual, that they carry with them through the developmental process, through maturation. Now, that hole may change shape. The size may grow, may shrink. It may be attended to in some domains and not in others. But it continues to exist. And it's a singularity, as Mr. Rhodes describes it. So if you will keep that image in mind as we talk, I hope I'll have time to come back to Mr. Rhodes and tell you a little bit about him. And you can really then think about whether or not, as a result of this trauma and others, he was also quite seriously physically abused and neglected by his stepmother in adolescence. But to see whether or not you feel whether he followed in some way an alternative pathway in his development, whether he developed biological, behavioral, or ecological kinds of ways of thinking, coping, feeling that might be different from individuals who did not have these kind of really severe negative experiences. So that's my challenge to you. The first thing I'm going to do is just give you a brief conceptual overview of trauma in the way that I'm using that term. Again, this is a definition by Lenore Tour. She is a clinical child psychiatrist, has done a great deal of both applied research and practice with traumatized children. And she defines trauma as the mental result of one sudden external blow or a series of blows, rendering the young child temporarily helpless and breaking past ordinary coping and defensive operations. Now, we probably could spend the rest of these 2 hours debating what trauma is and what it isn't. And please feel free to come back to me with questions along those lines. However, I want to go on and actually use child maltreatment as one example of a type of traumatic experience, however, clearly not the only type. And you can also think about whether or not I can make a case for connecting trauma and child maltreatment, and particularly connecting it to this larger notion of impacts on development and alternative developmental pathways. But secondly, we can really think about what a traumatic event is and how it might vary for individuals. So keep all of that in mind. TERS definition of trauma really leads to these conclusions, that the response to the traumatic event by the child is really twofold. And actually, the first is to adapt and accommodate to the trauma. So the second piece listed here is actually what we all do first when we've been traumatized, when we experience an intensely negative event that is profound enough that it really makes us stop in our tracks, so to speak. It also activates that fight-flight response that you heard Gabby talk about last week. So we're talking about enacting a biological stress response as part of this definition. So you adapt, you accommodate. Physiologically, you heard about the HPA axis and how that adaptation occurs, and how we also move to regain control through that particular feedback loop. We'll talk a little bit about what people do behaviorally in terms of adapting and accommodating. But the second very important objective is to regain mastery and control. If you think about it in your own lives, what is it that you do when you have a really horrendous experience? And let me just for a minute use a universal experience for us. If we think back to September 11th, now I don't have to do anything but give you a date, and my guess is that some of you kind of felt fluttering in the pit of your stomach. Some of you went, oh no, don't talk about that. Others kind of got goosebumps. Your hands got cold. Your feet may have gotten cold. You may have kind of shut me down, turned me off, or you may have really become more intensely focused on what I was going to say. That is a fairly universal traumatic event. Whether we were directly involved, somewhat distanced, some of you may have been living in New York or Washington, D.C. at the time, for example, that gave you more physical proximity. But all of us were affected. And you certainly may have taken some action, first of all, to adapt and to accommodate. You may have turned off the television after you saw the planes hitting the World Trade Center for the 75th time. Another group of you might have really stayed glued to that television. Both of those are ways of adapting and actually of mastering the experience so that you could go on. Some of you may have said, I'm never getting on an airplane again, ever. And some of you still may say, I have not been on an airplane since. My guess is that most of you who may not have had a predisposition to a fear of flying probably have ventured back into an airport and found all of the increased security, et cetera, some real reminders of that traumatic day. Some of you may have said, you know, I can't live on the top floor of this high rise anymore. I don't want to be near a high building. I had a colleague of mine who was looking out the window who said, look at those planes circling the John Hancock Center. This was here in Boston. I couldn't concentrate on the meeting we were having because I was just watching them. I knew they were going to hit. So thinking that the event was going to recur. And taking some precautionary steps. Those are all attempts to regain mastery and control. And at least from my perspective, to really adapt. Now, with children, that response, and with adults as well, but more powerfully with children, we at least propose that that response is conceptualized and incorporated into the child's cognitive and self structures. And that that really may create, in some very real ways, some differences in, again, the way they feel, the way they think, and the way they act, that may impact them in some situations lifelong. This model allows us to think about trauma and even psychopathology that results from traumatic experience as development and developmental differences in adaptation rather than a primary disease. And I want to propose to you to think about that alternative hypothesis, or that hypothesis as an alternative to the medical disease hypothesis. The notion that psychopathology is really a succession of adaptations of persons to their environments. And what should be added here to this quote, I think, is in the context of their immediate environments and taking into consideration their past environment, their genetic predisposition, and the interface of all of those factors. It's really a transactional, ecological kind of a model.
Kathy, but couldn't you also say that that pathology is simply like having a continuing a chronic disease?
Certainly. I think you could. And I think we even can argue that there are some chronic diseases that are adaptations to both our genetic makeup and our environment. So I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, and I think this is what makes it somewhat difficult to understand the concepts. What's really important here, though, Howard, is that if you will consider the alternative of thinking about psychopathology as adaptation that really may result in a disease entity or something that we're going to label as a disease, it really tells us very different things about how to go about intervening and treating it. And so the notion that people are really engaged in adaptive behavior instead of merely acting in a way that they have developed by habit based on some other circumstance or ideology is probably the important piece.
I like the reframing to get us out of the, well, it's just the disease model. But what I was suggesting is that, you know, there are certain diseases we get and we get a shot or we wait 5 days and we're fine. That's probably the same for certain traumas. You know, and so what is important about these early dramatic childhood trauma is like having diabetes or something like that. It's not really going to go away.
Exactly. And clearly what you said is all trauma is not alike. And adversity is something that in some ways can make each of us more resilient. And there really is some beginning evidence that we need a little bit of adversity in our lives to actually become more alert, more knowledgeable about that adversity. So that another argument is, are we really talking about a threshold effect? In other words, how much bad stuff is too much bad stuff and then is going to really move us into taking on ways of responding, of adapting, that is so primarily focused on avoiding trauma that it in some ways causes more dysfunction in our everyday lives. I'm not sure I totally buy the threshold effect model, but once you think about adaptation as an option, you really can, things become much more complex. Lori.
When you think of psychopathology as being adaptations to environments over time, are you referring solely to traumatic basis for psychopathology, or are you referring to psychopathology at large? Like, would you generalize that statement, or would you keep it to PTSD and things like it?
I think I would actually take a look at it, frankly, disorder by disorder, and I'm going to show you some of the proposed pathways to several adult disorders where this might be true. Clearly, there are disorders, psychiatric disorders that really have powerful genetic basis to them. Now, the severity of that disorder, for example, may or may not really be primarily affected by the environmental supports or stressors, so that in that case you really might see a situation where genetics plays a primary role, but environment really also may actually have more impact on the ultimate outcome measured by the function of that individual. You take a look at autism, for example. Clearly a genetically connected or linked disorder. But the treatment of those autistic children, the environments to which they are subjected, may make some critical difference in their ultimate functioning. And it gets back to the model of, is the child in the most need really the child for whom the environment makes the most difference? And again, in each case, you have to take a look at the disorder and the environmental impact. But it's interesting to see that in some cases that's true. There are two fundamental developmental changes that we have actually hypothesized that across the developmental spectrum really change in trauma. And one is that we see children and adolescents move from what is normative, a positivity bias, to really feeling negatively about themselves and seeing negativity in relationships. So that's the first. And the second is that instead of an ever-increasing integration of the self, we really see fragmentation of the self, so that understanding of who the child is in the context of the roles that they play does not become integrated into a core self, but really is fragmented. And I'll give you some examples. Just to give you a sense of a couple of ways that other work in development and developmental psychopathology have been linked. This is a quote by James Gabarino, who essentially talks about 70% of children experiencing serious trauma before age 5 will develop a primal philosophical wound of trauma. And he calls this the wound of the meaningfulness of life. In other words, the trauma that is severe enough can really deprive us of our ambition to live in a positive way within our environments, our world, which gets in another way to this kind of negativity, the view that the world is very threatening out there and that I may not even survive it. Another set of hypotheses have to do with attachment theory, and I'm assuming you all have the basic attachment theory lingo down. But when you talk about that one category of attachment, disorganized attachment, that's been very puzzling for researchers, the kids approach a caregiver, they avoid a caregiver, they whine, they're clingy, they kick the people they love. It's very confusing. And so in watching videotapes of these children, researchers said, these kids are just disorganized. They just don't know what they want. I'd actually propose when you look at disorganized attachment with a trauma frame, you see critical organization and you think of basic safety. I feel safe enough to approach and be nurtured because I really need that from this caregiver. But at the same time, I'm fearful because this is the same person who's supposed to love me and sometimes probably is loving but also really has hurt me. And so what do? You move forward, you kind of walk up, and then you withdraw, and then you approach, and then you avoid. Now, researchers who have looked beyond infancy talk about two different groups of children with disorganized attachment. They talk about one group of children with who use aggressive control to manage their disorganized attachment, their relationship with other caregiving people. And they talk about a second group of children who actually use nurturance and control. Already, I propose to you, we have two separate pathways, and I think that future research really hopefully will take these two disparate pathways, alternative pathways, as a response to really malignant caregiving and see where they go. Some of them may actually be somewhat predicted by gender. There are more girls in the nurturing controlling group and there are more boys in the aggressive controlling group, but obviously not in any way exclusively. So just to show you how some of this fits, our hypotheses are that these children who experience trauma are not fixated or delayed. They're not fixated in the Freudian sense. And again, for clinicians, this is huge because it means you don't just go back to the traumatic event, talk about it, work through it, understand it intellectually, and then people are free to kind of move on and mature. But it really means that they have continued to mature with this hole in their world and that they have reorganized it in increasingly complex way as they become more capable cognitively. And this is kind of a critical difference. Again, when I think about treatment, if I'm going to go in and provide therapy for a traumatized person, what this tells me is it isn't enough to go back and explore their trauma with them. Matter of fact, that may not be the most important thing or even a necessary thing to do with them. What may be more important is to help them with the behaviors that they've developed for coping with trauma. They're adaptive coping mechanisms that work for trauma, but don't work in everyday life. For example, if I imagine that everyone who approaches me is threatening, I am going to cut off and end a lot of interactions that might have benefited me in a very positive way. So if that's my response to trauma, I need some help in rethinking that particular process, for example. And that may be more important to me in really being functional in my everyday life than going back and understanding my traumatic experience. Now, there's some good reasons to do both. But without this kind of a model, we might just go back and explore the experience. I'm going to talk about two primary studies that I've been involved in, actually with Kurt, over the last 10 or 12 years. And both of these studies, and I'm talking about sub-studies within them, really propose that there are alternative, what we would call dysfunctional, alternative, deviant, different people call them different things, pathways. And that these are different but consistent patterns of development and developmental integration that become increasingly complex as the individual gains skill. What I hope I'm going to do is address ecology, behavior, and biology through the example of maltreated children and adolescents. So in this case, the ecology is the traumatic event or events, child maltreatment, behavior, negativity, and splitting, and the biology, which really has to do with the concept that there actually has been biological change in these children or adolescents as a result of their traumatic experience. And we're just beginning to explore these hypotheses, so would love to hear what you think. Let me start by just briefly telling you about some of the connections in the literature between biology and behavior. first of all, what do we know about the biological literature that tells us something about this negativity bias instead of positivity bias? I'm just going to mention these folks briefly and give you some references. Teacher and Rauch both talk about the left to right hemispheric shift and the notion that right hemispheric activity also really has to do with more negativity and also implicit memory for negative events. Increased arousal in the HPA axis, which Gabby talked about last week, and how ultimately for chronically traumatized adults, we know that they develop what is called this flat low diurnal rate of cortisol release. Essentially what happens seems to be is that the system just wears out and the HPA axis really shifts so that we see little or no cortisol release at the end of that cycle. And again, if that really is the hormone that brings us back into control after feeling increased stress, you can imagine what the body system might look like without being able to return to control. And I'd even propose to you the two girls that you saw in what we call the bus incident. They were really persistent with each other in their negativity. One hypothesis is it that both of these girls really had a biological predisposition to this because they were unable to come back and take a step back, take a deep breath, and get back in control physiologically? Were they able? Just a couple of other arguments.
On that previous slide, mm-hmm. when you talk about the left to right hemisphere shift, are you saying that on a particular task, you actually can look at some kind of a brain image and say whether the child is likely to be a victim of trauma? I just concretize the left-to-right hemisphere shift, because I don't know what that means.
I can tell you what's been done with adults. With adult Vietnam vets, they actually were doing imaging and showed them both positive and negative images and actually asked them to perform concrete tasks and found that there was much, much more right hemispheric activity than left when they compared that with non-combat veterans. So that this has really been found in adults, but not, I don't know of any studies with children.
I don't know if you remember the details of the study, but is it like when they saw photographs of carnage that...
No, these were much more benign, but positive, and some had positive and negative valence, and some were really just cognitive tasks, so that it was not just in recall. There also are some studies about recall that really demonstrate much more wider use of the right hemisphere.
Would it be distinguishable from depressed people?
There is a brand new article out actually about depressed children that is very interesting. That it's hard to know what the images would look like, but in terms of cortisol response, this is a paper that really talks about depressed children having very high cortisol levels. And so for me, either we're really seeing different patterns of response from the HPA axis, for example, with depression and trauma. The other possibility really might be that there's a sequential process going on here, and that in chronically low stress situations, we see the normative rise and fall of cortisol, which really represents the HPA axis functioning. In moderate levels of stress, and this has been documented now with depression in children and some in poverty, children living in extreme poverty, where we see these high levels of cortisol and even some of the these elevations of cortisol in the afternoon with children, for example, in childcare. One possibility is that this is a process that initially what the body does is it responds by really, you know, maintaining a fairly high level of cortisol. And then, because cortisol is actually quite damaging to the body when it's elevated over time, we again physiologically adapt and say, you know, enough of this, and actually, or there may be a depletion hypothesis there working too. This is just to remind you of the data that Gabby showed you on Monday, and how even with a very small number of children, we found that all of the kids in pink are the abused children, and the non-abused children are blue, and the differences were really striking. Just so you know about the practical data collection process here, I think it was 2 years ago that we completed, 2 years ago this spring we completed the study. We have been collecting cortisol samples, as you saw in the film on Monday, from children since that time, over time. The problem is that we really have to run the assays all at once. So we have a freezer full of little tubes of saliva, and we are anxiously waiting until this spring when we feel like we have, I think we'll end up with, Gabby, help me think, 30 children, which doesn't sound huge, but really looking at their cortisol levels on 4 to 8 occasions over time. And all of these children have been in therapy at the time, so in part we want to see whether or not therapy and the larger therapeutic involvement that they have actually has any impact on their cortisol levels. But we're waiting until this summer to really pull all of these samples out of the freezer and to see whether or not this is really just a fortuitous finding or whether it really holds. Okay. Here are just some other things that have been found in literature. A reduction in the size of the corpus callosum, which really argues that there's reduced integration between hemispheres, which is something that would, again, we could talk about this notion of the lack of integration of self and whether this reduced integration might really support the propensity to actually split off and not integrate domains. Increased arousal of the amygdala, which we know is critical in part of the trauma process, and whether continued increased arousal in the amygdala would make an individual more sensitive to really tuning into sensory and affective states, and particularly the use of affective and state affective state memory, rather than thinking about hippocampal memory and long-term memory. And this may in some way explain some of the memory deficits and idiosyncrasies we see in trauma. And finally, there is some evidence of hippocampal interference and damage with particularly recurrent trauma. But we know that that with this kind of interference, we may see fragmentation and time-space distortion, compartmentalization, and again, unintegrated memory. So that, again, these are just some basic findings that we think may be promising. Tell you a little bit about the Developmental Pathways Project, some of what we found. I then want to show you a little bit more videotape of the two girls that you saw and see if I can answer some of the questions that were, or maybe raise more questions around the questions that were asked last Monday about what a therapist do. We now have 120 children. I'm going to tell you about a couple of sub-studies And again, we hypothesize that maltreated children would be more negative and more fragmented in their organization of self in relationship to others. Just to give you a sense of the sample, these kids are 18 to 62 months. They have been followed anywhere from about 9 months to 3 years, depending on their availability and the time that they actually spent in programs. This is really a low-income, urban sample. All these children are in child care. Half of them have been maltreated, half have not. Just to give you a sense of the extent of the maltreatment, 73% of the maltreated children in the sample had two or more forms of maltreatment. So we're really looking at kids with pretty severe maltreatment histories.
Have all of these kids been removed from the maltreated environment?
No. And that's really a factor that we will be looking at. Some of them are in foster care. Some of them are with biological parents. Some of them are in adoptive homes. Some of them are with relatives. And this is really an ecological study, which I think is, as Gabby said last week, it's hell for the researcher, because you have moving targets where there are lots of differences that are very hard to control for. But it really is access to a very high-risk population of children that's very hard to find otherwise.
If you don't work in the situation, it might seem that these kids should be removed from the homes. But in fact, removing them from the homes is often exacerbating the trauma. The best solution is usually to help the parents to not be abusive anymore.
Right.
Taking kids out of the homes sometimes leads to clearly worse outcomes.
Exactly. Again, just to give you a sense, we're not just interested in whether or not abuse occurred, but the frequency with which it occurred and the severity with which it occurred. As you can see here, for many of these children, abuse is continuous. Most of them had severe to serious abuse. All of the abuse was identified as present by Department of Social Services. So, these are the things we thought we would find. Bias for the negative, that children would choose negative interactions, that they describe themselves in negative terms, and that they would spontaneously enact negative social exchanges, even when they were offered positive. And we started with a study of 20 toddlers. We're now following this up with a study of 60 toddlers and preschoolers. And I want to give you some examples of what we found, if I can kind of demonstrate these schemas for emotional expression. The positive relationships were really conventionalized, bland. Positive relationships tended to show themes of loss, so that even when we were able to move children to do positive, to tell positive stories, there were loss themes in many of them. One of the key things that we saw was that even positive relationships were converted to negative, so that oftentimes stories about interpersonal encounters ended in disaster. Dynamic relationships were richly textured, negative, aggressive, violent, much more so than the non-abusive children. We also saw merging of positive and negative, and we saw identification with the aggressor. In other words, children who very quickly decided they didn't want to be victims and took another role, said, I'm going to be the person doing the hitting. Let me give you some examples. First of all, the merging of positive and negative. Here's a little girl, Patty, and we do all this through using the nice and mean scale. These particular data are from that information, although we also looked at all these themes and emotions during therapy over time. But Patty has two dolls that are supposed to enact a nice scene, kicking the ball, playing ball with each other. She's seen this from an examiner. She takes the dolls and the ball, and she hits the ball back and forth once, and she says, they kiss, they bite, and she knocks the dolls together. Donald. Donald is 2.5, by the way. Give you some examples of converting positive to negative. Listen to the texture in his negative story, and then see what he does with a positive story at the end. Donald was given the same scenario, and so he's really supposed to demonstrate a nice interaction. He takes the two dolls, and immediately one doll forcefully says to the other, "Guy, you want to fight? I'll knock you down." He fights them. They fight. "You want to fight? You want to fight? Fuck my butt. Fuck it, fuck it, fuck it. Kill you, kill you, kill you. Bite." That's Donald. The examiner doesn't give up. She says, "Donald, let's try this again." She shows him the positive two kids playing ball, one called Donald, one with Donald's friend's name, and says, "Donald, can you do this?" Donald takes the two dolls, he knocks the ball back and forth, and he says, "Have the ball, guy, have the ball. Don't leave me. Please don't leave me." And you hear the lost message. That's Donald. We had children when we did this, when one doll was their adult caregiver and the other doll had their name. They would either refuse completely to get involved in any nice or mean encounters in that situation, or oftentimes they would turn as the aggressor. And they would actually have, for example, the mommy doll hit the self doll or punish the self doll, the Donald doll, for example, as a third party. So those are the kinds of things that we found qualitatively. Pamela Raya, in a dissertation some years ago, looked at these same children and actually preliminarily identified three groups of children based on their emotions. She found a group that were really angry, a group that were fearful, and a third group that were really positive about everything but quite rigid and quite superficial about the positivity. But these were the same kids that in private were picking on younger children. There were more girls in group three. The kids in group two, we had more documentation of episodes of physical abuse or neglect. They had been in foster care. There were real loss issues. And group one, these were children who really had been exposed to really high levels of aggression. We saw more kids from homes where there was domestic violence. So this gave us some sense that we actually were seeing differentiation of these kinds of patterns. So we went on to think about, okay, does it make any difference if children see negativity where they really should see something neutral or positive? Does it affect their cognition? What does it mean for them actually in performing given tasks? And is it going to make any difference in how they learn? And so this essentially first was our question, well, really as a group, did we see the maltreated children as seeing things more negatively than the non-maltreated children? And then what does this mean? This is just a description of the nice and mean scale. I assume you all at least have heard about it briefly, but that's what we use, and you have a description of it in your handout. What did we find? First of all, we did find statistically significant differences between the non-maltreated children and the maltreated children. This is the mean difference of children's stories with a positive valence, and you can see the non-maltreated children are always blue and the maltreated are pink. I'm not quite sure why, but... And you can see here that the non-maltreated children told many more positive stories. The maltreated children told many more negative stories. So at least we could verify within a group that that was true. Then again, we went on to ask, so does this affect their learning in the context of cognitive skill? Yes?
This may be a really simplistic question, but why do the kids always use the names of themselves or people that they know for the dolls? Because might it be that they're kind of identifying certain emotions or positive or negatives with those particular people, as opposed to using names of the people they don't know, which may be a more abstract idea of their ability to have positive or negative balances.
But what we really want to know is what they, what their emotional representations are in context, because for us that's really the purest way of really understanding what they actually might be thinking and doing. Now, there are other researchers who have found a real split in traumatized children between their ability to conceptualize the abstract of nice and mean relationships and how they actually manage those relationships in relationship to the self. So that for us it was particularly important that the children identify with the dolls, one as self and one as someone that they knew as either a friend in the peer nice and mean or with a parent or caregiver in the adult nice and mean. Do you want to add to that?
That's something that varies across studies, and in the few studies that have tried to that have compared the two ways of presenting it, you seem to get more of the emotional biases that you're trying to assess when you have them use the self and friend or sibling names rather than the stranger names.
In that particular qualitative study, we also went back and literally watched, actually I did, went back and watched videotapes, encoded, looked at these children in relationships, in therapy, encoded their levels of instrumental aggression and verbal aggression and verbal cooperation and instrumental cooperation, and we found that in terms of their behaviors, we had the same findings. So that was another way to verify that these children in their daily encounters were actually engaged in much more negative versus positive behavior, and that that fit with their representations. We did that very deliberately. Now the question was, so can these children perform cognitively in the context, or how do they perform cognitively in the context of positive and negative emotions? So again, we looked at the nice and mean scale, and we looked at two different measures of skill, of cognitive skill. The first is really the full definition of cognitive skill that Kurt has used in developing the measure. And this is really a work in progress, so we'd love your input. But essentially, we were trying to really define the primary tasks that it takes to really pass on any given, on each given task, to really pass the cognitive skill. The child has to attend, they have to hear the story the examiner is telling them and showing them with the dolls. They then have to be able, they have to be able to focus on that task in order to, they have to be able to comprehend it. They then have to be able to reproduce it verbally or non-verbally for the examiner. So they either have to be able to, from a visual motor perspective, reproduce it, or they have to be able to verbally tell the story. So they have to have some sense of narrative construction. To just tell a spontaneous story, you don't need all of those components. Essentially, you have to be able to comprehend the story that may be cued from something that you heard, and you have to be able to construct a simple verbal or nonverbal narrative. So, what did we find with the maltreated and non-maltreated children? In terms of being able to meet the first hurdle, in other words, in order to be able to construct that narrative that was told to them, to repeat it back in a cogent way, to really handle all of those facets of cognitive skill exchange, the maltreated and non-maltreated children perform very differently. The non-maltreated children actually did not perform quite as well at the younger ages, but as they got older, as you can see, the blue line, the slope is so much steeper. The maltreated children really did much more poorly. And preliminarily, a number of people have said, well, maybe they're just not as cognitively capable. Maybe we really have a difference here that has to do with primary cognition, has to really do with learning. In other words, these kids just don't get it. That's pretty much what this says. Now, we weren't really willing to stop there. So we really said, so what is it about the stories that we're asking these children to tell that the non-maltreated kids get and the maltreated kids don't? And what's really interesting is it was the positive stories that they were failing. Because of time, I'm not going to show you the negative stories, but there really was no difference in terms of their ability to grasp the stories and to pass that cognitive task with that level of understanding at that particular skill level.
You mean no difference between the non-maltreated and the maltreated?
Non-maltreated and maltreated.
So
on the negative stories. On the positive stories, the maltreated children weren't learning at all. They've got a flat line here. They were not able to pass the cognitive stories. Now, our conclusions from this preliminarily, I think, really could be wide-reaching, and so we're really looking to reproduce this. But the notion that children who have been traumatized in threatening ways, or at least who have serious maltreatment experiences in their histories, are unable to reproduce and function and engage in a task with another individual around positive material. I mean, what is it that these kids are going to have to do when they get into kindergarten and first grade? They're going to have to sit in the classroom, listen to a teacher, hopefully say positive things to them, and be able to then grasp that and reproduce it for her in some way to demonstrate their learning. And so one of the questions that this finding really raises is, are these kids really going to have difficulty with that, as opposed to giving them a negative set? Yes?
Are those kinds of skills considered more neutral, I suppose, than being able to relate a positively emotionally laden story versus a negatively emotionally laden story? And I guess I'm wondering how this relates to that sort of cognitive learning.
I think that's a good question, and I don't know that we have the answer at this point in time. We're in the process of actually looking at the children's interactions in positive, negative, and neutral pretend play through their therapy sessions to really try to see and answer that question, because I think that's a good question. I think from looking at the vignettes, the sense is that these children really take whatever material they have and they really make it very, very negative. So they really are, my guess would be, if I have to create the develop the next hypothesis, it's the positive and the neutral material that they're really responding to, but I can't say that.
Kathy, do you have vocabulary measures on these kids?
We don't have them on these children, but we have them on the early Head Start children,
right.
And we just replicated these findings in early Head Start.
Right, but you haven't looked at the vocabulary yet.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we know that vocabulary does not make a difference.
Yeah, I think that's what Dante Giacchetti...
Vocabulary does not make a difference.
Well, we did a study with Dante Giacchetti, too,
yeah.
With abused kids using similar measures, and I believe he also, when you control for vocabulary, at least you still get this effect.
Right.
So vocabulary is one measure of ability that, there might be a group mean difference, but when you control for that, you still get the effect.
And in the early Head Start study, here we really controlled for age, but in the early Head Start study, we were able to control for a number of other things. We could control for cognitive skill. We used the Bailey, which is a diagnostic cognitive measure. We were able to control for language, for vocabulary production, for actually both expressive and receptive language, we were really able to do a much better job. And that was a low-income sample without kids actually specifically identified as maltreated. What we found was that the parents who were the harshest disciplinarians were the ones who had children who looked like this. One of our other questions here was, so what are these maltreated children doing? So we looked at their coping strategies, and I just want to show you this simply to say that these weren't children who were just kind of sitting there going, you know, I just don't get the task. They were actually engaged in using many more coping strategies than their non-maltreated counterparts. And as they got older, they continued to use more and more of those coping strategies. Finally, what this single line represents is the performance of both of the maltreated and non-maltreated children when we didn't ask them to reproduce the story that we'd told, when we just looked at their cognitive skill level based on any spontaneous or modeled story. And what we found was that both the maltreated and the non-maltreated children were able to pass an equal number of cognitive tasks. So for us, this said that it's really not a matter of basic cognitive learning, but there is, our hypothesis now is that there are things that are interfering with the child's ability to attend and with their ability to really think about and reproduce positive events.
Just in terms of analyzing the data that you have, since you're looking at differences, how is it that you can, you know, look at means? Is there any times when you feel like the mean doesn't really capture what's going on for any individual child?
Yes, actually, we're doing much more than looking at means. What happens when you try to present something this succinctly is that...
I'm wondering if that's something that you have, you know, talked about.
I have to say that I was not expecting to find such powerful differences. I wasn't expecting to find mean differences. I thought we would actually have more of a continuous variable that would really move from... Looking at exposure to, this is really to family violence, and seeing changes on a continuum. And I was actually quite surprised that the two groups were really so powerfully separated. And that's when we went to using means as one way of really demonstrating this process. But what we're really interested at this point in is really looking at these children over time. And in that case, by doing some multi-level modeling, we're really going to be able to look at each time point. For example, we are coding, and there are some people in here who are actually doing this who are in my research course. We're coding for episodes of pretend play within each therapy session. Therapy sessions are all videotaped. We are coding pretend play in the context of the child's themes, emotions, and then we're also have an interactive coding scheme, which I'm just getting ready to talk about, where we're looking at what does the therapist do, what does the child do, what does the other child do, what does the other therapist do. You add to that the coding that Gabby did around touch, and we hope to put all that together to really look at how these children change or don't change over time.
I guess part of my point, too, is that the anecdotes and kind of the open-ended examples that you've given us are so powerful. It's hard to, I can see that it would be really hard to present in a format like this.
It is. Thanks. I want to just tell stories, and it doesn't always work.
Yeah. Kathy, you asserted that the maltreated have more coping strategies. But what are they, and how do we know they have more? I mean, you could say exactly the opposite, that maybe the non-maltreated have more coping strategies, and that's why we don't see any problems. But I mean, that's being facetious.
Right.
But what it's very helpful for us to know what do you have in mind when you talk about the
right.
the variety of
right.
coping
we
strategies.
We actually outlined a series of coping strategies, some of which, by the way, we thought would have a positive effect on passing a task, and others might not, and we're finding that's not true. We're in the process of really analyzing that. We looked at children who actually refused or were distracted, which is kind of negative in its context. We looked at children who developed their own spontaneous story. We looked at children who elaborated on stories. And we looked at children who switched either the valence of the story or the role of the protagonist. And what we essentially did was we went in and looked at what both the maltreated and non-maltreated children tended to be doing in terms of being able to get through the stories. And that's essentially what we're looking at this point in time. What we found, again, in the early Head Start sample is that the children who elaborate on their stories actually do better at passing the task. As you might imagine, the children who were really distracted or refused to tell the story didn't pass. Children who tell spontaneous stories don't do as well. And children who switch some element of the story, you would think that they would not do as well, but some of them do better. So we're still in the process of looking at that. And I'm not sure this is the way to look at coping strategies. So I'd also welcome some ideas. We have videotapes of these children and probably could be looking at them for the next 20 years. So. Yeah.
In this model, you take account for that there's not necessarily a deficit or a retardation in developmental due to, like, the trauma and psychopathology. But is there, like, any studies that would say that there's a deficit in, like, say, theory of mind and theory building in representations of self? And have you done any theory of mind testing? And to see that there is a deficit in the ability to, you know, have a negative bias on the basis of not having a full abstract thought of the true intentions and desires and hopes of others and beliefs of others. And, like, you know what I mean? That kind of interaction of understanding self and the position and roles of others. Is there a deficit in retardation in that area?
I'd like to hypothesize that probably that's one of the areas where we're going to see a deficit. There are several researchers who have kind of pushed the notion in that direction. I think that we could think about some of what we've done with the nice and mean and try to conceptualize this as a very early theory of mind piece. I would think ideally it would be interesting to do that with school-aged maltreated children or even to follow up on these children. There is some evidence that maltreated children, for example, have more difficulty using feeling state words. There is some evidence with adolescents, again, that there is this split between their ability to abstract about particularly about infractions or harm to others and what they would actually do in a situation that was very personal to them. So that I think all of these things really say that that's going to be a really productive direction to
Kathy, are you going to talk about adolescence?
Yes.
Because one of the things that really, first of all, I think you need to think about different pathways that come from maltreatment, not just maltreated kids. And one of the things that really struck me when we started talking about this work was that that among the adolescents and adults, some of them do remarkable tasks of coordinating different ways of approaching different people in different situations. Now, whether that's how that relates to theory of mind tasks, I'm not sure. But the kind of perspective taking that's involved to switch your whole personality based on who you're interacting with or what your goals or their goals are at the moment, the way people do when, in the extreme cases, you have multiple personality disorder, it's really a phenomenal skill at perspective taking shift, which is at least connected theoretically to a theory of mind.
Exactly. Although I think that the perspective-taking approach is a bit more concrete. But again, when you start talking about kind of the splitting of the self, that also may occur in so many different ways. It's an interesting way to look at things. Let me talk a little bit about the more practical. So what do we know about these kids and what about the research. In response to some of the questions that you you asked on Monday, I actually put this piece back in, and I hope we have time to talk about adolescence too. But we actually, as I said, took a look at the children's peer and adult-child interaction in weekly therapy sessions over time. And we coded for proximity, cooperation, friendship and perspective-taking, verbal interaction. And you know what is missing on this list? We also coded for conflict. I'm not going to comment on my own perspective-taking.
Positivity bias.
Here, conflict's always really anxiety-producing. This is a little bit more information about the two girls that you saw in the bus incident. And I want to use them as a case study, and I also want to show you another session of their play so that we can think about some of the questions that you ask and some of your comments about, so what were these therapists doing and what kind of difference did it make? Just to give you a little bit more information, I need to tell you, Tanisha is really Tati, and Christina is really Chelsea, and we're giving you their real names. Again, as Gabby mentioned on Monday, we'd ask for you to keep this confidential. They've given us permission to use these videos, and it's hard to disguise their names when they use them on screen. But this is how old the children were when they started pair play therapy. They show you that we followed them for 19 sessions. This tells you a little bit about their mothers were both mid-20s, early 30s, obviously both single African-American women, low SES, at the time were welfare dependent, were involved with Child Protective Services. Both of these girls had been in foster care removed from their homes at a period of time and were back with their mothers. So they were both physically abused and neglected. You were asking, so what do therapists who do this kind of work, what are their guidelines? Here are some of the guidelines that they tell us that they use and that we also offer, and I wanted to give you a sense of a frame for the kind of treatment they were doing. And then I'd like for you to really to take a critical look at what you think may be happening. This is relational treatment. It's really aimed at helping young children who are having difficulty develop friendships, and it's really based on the work that's been done. That one says that friendship making is a skill that needs to be developed very early on. It's fairly stable, as is aggression over time, and that children without a single friend tend to be those children who are the most emotionally dysfunctional. There's a wonderful study that was done by Maureen Colleen and her colleagues at the University of Georgia that looked at children from kindergarten through 12th grade and actually went in and asked, who were your three good friends, and really looked both at the children who had lots of friends, who had one friend, and then those children who no one listed as their friend. And it was those children who no one listed over time. And it was found to be a fairly stable characteristic. Matter of fact, from a statistical point of view, I helped Maureen as a methodological consultant look at change over time in friendships. And we looked at the individual changes in friendship patterns, these children from K through 12, and found that this was a real statistical bust because most of them were zero. And so we had to look at the subgroups, small subgroups of kids who did change. Anyway, so relational, follow the child's lead, although not to the extreme. There is a type of therapy called non-directive play therapy that has really predominated in working with young children, and there is much more direction in this treatment. The purpose of the therapist is to create opportunities for interaction. By the way, the whole underlying construct that's so basic I didn't even put it on this list is you create a safe environment. You do welcome the opportunities to work through both cooperation and conflict. You model and reinforce cooperation without cutting off conflict. You model non-aggressive responses so that the therapist may really let conflictual instances go, but not to the point of physical aggression. Establish clear boundaries and really use the ecological setting. What that means is that we feel that this treatment is much more effective if we go into the child care center and provide the service there. And sometimes that means noise outside the door and disruption because the kids are going on a field trip today when you really had therapy, or a small room or a huge room. We've done this in oversized space, undersized space. Sometimes we really try to pick a variety of toys and then make it special to the child's needs, but sometimes that's not totally possible to, so that we really have to go with the environment. Okay. With that in mind, I'm going to show you another session with Tati and Chelsea. I want you to know that this is actually a later session. It's closer to, I think it may be their, even their second to the last session.
I'm there with Catherine.
Yeah, so that's
These children before, how you saw them today, and having some sense at least of guidelines for what therapists are supposed to be thinking about. Thoughts? Do these seem like the same children that you saw? Probably about, let me think about it, that session 9, 10 weeks. The session you saw last Monday was session 9, and this was probably session 18, and they had probably missed a week in there, so.
One-on-one therapy, anything else?
Good question. They both continued in a therapeutic classroom. They were both at home with their mothers. They had, mothers had ongoing protective service counseling. In that time, actually, Tati's mother had been raped by strangers, so that there were some other serious issues going on in her home. But they were not receiving any individual treatment. Again, there was a therapist working with the mothers on site. So that was concurrent.
So you mean there was no other one-on-one therapy?
No. No. Neither of these children had individual therapy. The choice was this kind of relational treatment rather than one-on-one.
Yeah, so what my question is, have they tried, I mean, is it that the children do not have the cognitive ability for one-on-one, you know, a debriefing, for example, at intervals after this sort of therapy would not be helpful to ask them, so, you know, what were you doing and what was, you know, how was the play more enjoyable, and asking them to sort of metacognition, you know, think about what was good and...
Remember, these are children under 3. So I think you're pushing them beyond their cognitive capacity, which brings up a real challenge. And remember, these are kids who are pre-operational, that, you know, they live in the present. They are representational. And we really feel like children can enter into treatment when they become representational. Although there are other ways of doing primary work with infants that's more sensory motor in its function.
The question I have is, I mean, it seems like this is
a huge improvement over the last episode that we saw, the session that we saw, as far as the kids being more comfortable with each other and being more productive and positive and, you know, just a big improvement. And I'm wondering, the skeptic in me is wondering, is this an example of a true improvement of that degree, or is this a really good day compared to a really bad day?
Great question. Actually, let me show you. What we've done for each of our pairs, and now I think have about 40 pairs where we've done this, we've actually tracked the changes in treatment over time. So this looks at 19 sessions, and we coded their, blind coders coded their interaction levels from 1 to 5, 1 being that there is no interaction at all. 2 is more of a totally separate parallel play. 3 is some interaction that really can't be sustained. 4 is really the kind of engagement that you saw with them on the video, but with only with support of the therapist. And 5 is independent, which again I think you saw in the video when, you know, they would actually turn to each other and engage and really kind of had to bring the therapist along rather than the other way around. And again, Tati's blue and Chelsea's red, and this is essentially a session-by-session view of, particularly in the context of cooperation. So we saw some early cooperation that they weren't able to sustain without the therapist. And then you see in the middle of treatment, their cooperative behaviors really plummeted. What happened to conflict? And you can see that Chelsea really engaged in more conflict than Tati. But you see that shortly after, by the time they got to session 3 or so, the conflict escalated and then it diminished. It increased at the end, but interestingly enough, the conflict was of a very different dimension. And so this is why we need to look at multiple dimensions. Our question, which is this the working phase of therapy? And I know someone on Monday raised the issue of, wouldn't you really want to kind of pull these kids back and not let them do as much engagement in conflict? You know, the bus scene went on, felt like kind of forever. You know, would you want to contain them more? And that's a realistic question about treatment.
Something very striking to me in the graphs, you know, I'm going to ask this if I don't know anything, is that the graphs look just remarkably similar for two separate girls, even most blatantly for cooperation, where they're identical, but also quite similar for conflict. Now, some dyads, I would guess, aren't so closely linked.
That's right. I think that preliminarily to date, we've identified at least what seem to be 4 different patterns. And one really is that the kids are so out of sync. I need to tell you something about these two girls, though. There is a secret here. And that is that they were referred to pair play therapy because they were the two oldest girls in their toddler classroom. And the teacher came to us and said, one of these kids has to go. We, even in this therapeutic school, we can, in this therapeutic program, they cannot both be together because they try to engage with each other and it ends in disaster every time, and we never, and they gravitate to each other. So that in some way, I think these girls had some advantage, frankly, because although they were really into this negative relationship that they both sustained and tended to end in physical blows, they were they had some kind of a synchronized relationship. So they were chosen for this pair because they already had a relationship that actually needed some reworking. And we knew because we'd worked with both these children from the time they were older infants, that this was really their first attempt at friendship and friendship relationships. So. Mark.
Yeah, the graph representing the dyad between the two children, not between the therapist and the child.
Right.
Cooperation of cooperating with the adult, they're cooperating with one another, correct?
Right. This is cooperation with one another.
Reciprocity, then,
yes,
in the relationship.
Okay. Yeah. This is only peer-to-peer, although we our coding scheme actually looks at all four. It gets a little daunting. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there are any takeaways here for working with non-maltreated children. I mean, you know, do you learn if this hypothesis that the working phase of therapy is when you let the conflict escalate, I mean, does that only apply to maltreated, or do you think it's great to let just normal kids fight? Or, I mean, what are the connections here to
good, great
outside
question.
This realm?
I think you have twins. Oh, boy, is this a loaded question. Actually, if you're talking about in the context of therapy, I think it's very hard to do treatment when you don't see the negative behaviors for which the child has actually presented. And oftentimes, this is what we're not able to do in individual treatment, because my guess is these children would be a lot less aggressive with an adult, a single adult, in treatment than they are in looking at this relationship. Now, one of the things that we have to do, I'll use this to try to answer your question, is when we talk about being clear about the boundaries, we really let the girls know that there are things that they can do in therapy. When they walk across the hall into the classroom, they can't do those things. And interestingly enough, our interns also are pair play therapists. They also are in the classroom with these children, so that we're hoping that the generalization from the positive behaviors in pairs carry over to the classroom, but there also is some limit setting, so that we're really trying to help the girls learn what they can do in one context but not in another. And we're actually finding that children are really quite able to grasp that by about three. Yes.
The lower end of the scale are 0 and 1. I mean, what evidence is there for those numbers there? And I would imagine it indicates some kind of a negative interaction, but I'm wondering if that could also have a positive spin to it, in that at least they're interacting, even if it's conflict, so that there's some kind of communication to work with, as opposed to sort of the parallel play where you just, like, forget you.
That's our spin, but there certainly are others. And, you know, one of our questions is, do some of these children who continue to have these negative encounters when they try to connect actually end up does some of them end up withdrawing? Does that become their ultimate adaptive response? And there is some evidence. Actually, George and Maine did a wonderful study on maltreated children and peer relationships, and what they found was that when maltreated preschoolers were approached by another, they often refused to engage, or they saw it as a threat. If they initiated the interaction, then the interaction could continue. But consequently, these very young children really, you know, excluded a number of interactions because they hadn't initiated them. So we actually were using some of that work to try to mold our conceptualization of what was happening here. Yes?
I was wondering about the on the Monday film that we saw. Well, first of all, the researchers kept saying, you know, oh, you're angry, and in a tone that sounded almost soothing and a little bit, slightly almost, there wasn't any sense of negativity in the tone, and I was wondering, well, that must have been a deliberate choice, and I was wondering why that choice was made.
Sure, that was a deliberate choice. And it certainly was probably not the only choice. It was a choice that was made particularly with young children who had experienced so much negative verbal as well as physical input, that these children, their primary experience was really having people yelling at them. And so there were two objectives here: to kind of get them to listen to calmer kinds of tones, but to also be very clear about what was happening without, frankly, triggering their stress mechanisms by the very tone of voice. And the whole notion that if you can maintain some calm and still intercede, that you may have more chance to actually capture the child's attention. Now, that's something that's fairly well accepted in clinical practice. I don't know of anyone who's designed an empirical study to actually look at that, and it's, it'd be an interesting question. And I worry some, for example, given what we know about the children's ability to attend to positive encounters, if we can generalize from positive storytelling to other positive situations.
I was wondering about the on the Monday film that we saw. The people, the researchers kept saying, you know, oh, you're angry, you're angry, you're angry, and in a tone that sounded almost soothing and a little bit, slightly almost, there wasn't any sense of negativity in the tone, and I was wondering, that must have been a deliberate choice, and I was wondering why that choice was made.
Sure, that was a deliberate choice, and it certainly was probably not the only choice. It was a choice that was made particularly with young children who had experienced so much negative verbal as well as physical input, that these children, their primary experience was really having people yelling at them. And so there were two objectives here, to kind of get them to listen to calmer kinds of tones, but to also be very clear about what was happening without, frankly, triggering their stress mechanisms by the very tone of voice. And the whole notion that if you can maintain some calm and still intercede, that you may have more chance to actually capture the child's attention. Now, that's something that's fairly well accepted in clinical practice. I don't know of anyone who's designed an empirical study to actually look at that, and it would be an interesting question. And I worry some, for example, given what we know about the children's ability to attend to positive encounters, if we can generalize from positive storytelling to other positive situations.
Or even if they know the meaning of that intonation.
Right. The hope is that we would teach them some of the more positive, some of the variances in positive intonation, and even neutral intonation. The neutral acknowledgement is really different of a feeling. It's really very different than saying you can't hit. And what both of the therapists did in the Monday tape, I think, is very much moved in quite physically. I think that they also really knew that words weren't going to make it here. And rather than allowing these children to get into physical altercations, which they'd done before, in the classroom, that they moved in very, very quickly to use caring physical restraint, with which they were also really quite careful, by the way. But again, there might be another way to do this.
Maybe just to throw a bit of a cynical spin on looking at the graphs, it seems that both of them start and end at pretty much the same point quantitatively. Now, I mean, one thing I think is, you know, seeing the title, this is the working phase of therapy, is there something to make you think that something progressive happened qualitatively, even though that they may have exhibited the same amount of conflict, that it's going up? Or if you do it over more time, are you sure that you won't just see a cycle where the pattern is kind of up, down, up, down? And I'm sure you have other case examples.
Great question. This is the best evidence that I have that there there were some permanent changes quantitatively that were being documented qualitatively. These children stayed in the same classroom, by the way, and actually left being very good friends, and the teacher was just amazed. Now, that's kind of the, you know, the qualitative piece. We measured what we called friendship perspective taking also on a 1 to 5 scale, where a 4 was, again, some of that mutual exchange with support, and a 5 was independent exchange. And here you can see what, how the girls progressed over time. And it's a choppy road, but they really started with very, very little interest or ability in being able to sustain an interaction that would lead to friendship. And by the time they left, they really were sustaining one. Now, your question is still valid. So these girls left, they went to kindergarten, and did they ever make another friend? And we haven't followed up on them. I actually have seen Chelsea. I saw her when she was 8, and she's now 12. I know that she's doing fairly well. I know that her mother has done fairly well. Her mother is working. Her mother, by the way, is a college graduate, interestingly enough, and was at the time that Chelsea was maltreated. Also was a woman who had been in foster care for most of her life and severely abused herself physically and sexually as a child. And Chelsea, my understanding, at least anecdotally, is doing quite well. Tati, we've lost touch. I know her mother actually ended up, had been in jail before for drug use and is back in jail, and we can't find her. And would love to be able to find her and bring these two girls back together. So I don't know that I can answer your question, and it's a critical one, and it's one that we need to, I mean, longitudinal studies are so important and also so difficult with these families. So,
can I ask a question about the play aspect?
Sure.
I'm, for my project for this class, I'm looking at particular types of play and whether or not they correlate with social competence. So my question is about interpreting what's going on. Since I'm looking only at the at-risk kids, and we don't have any, you know, we don't have play for children who are from the non-at-risk type of situation. I mean, they wouldn't need pair play therapy, to, you know. So I'm just kind of, I mean, for me, like, if I could ideally design my study, what I would do is compare these at-risk children during therapy with their play outside of the pair play therapy context, and then look for parallels. But I guess I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on how I might think about this without it having a control.
Right. We've actually thought about both of those options. It's the reason that we have two measures of social competence. We have one that's observational by the teacher in the classroom called the California Social Competence Measure. And the second that Gabby described, that's really an observational measure of play that has a social competence score component that we actually apply to use actually on the videotapes, and we also use that measure in the classroom, started to use it in the classroom. So I think you're right on the money for saying, so how do constructs like social competence generalize, particularly in children who have experienced trauma where they may really do very well in one setting and not well in another. So let me just leave you, because as usual I have more to say than there is time, with a bit of information on adolescents. This is a particular study on adolescent girls, and I just want to show you that we have, I think, some evidence that does support the pathways notion, and kind of see how we're seeing some of the same patterns, I think, in adolescent girls. This was a sample of adolescent girls, all of whom were hospitalized, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the sample in a minute. But these were sexually abused girls, and we, again, hypothesized they'd represent themselves negatively, that they would demonstrate splitting rather than an integrated self, and that they would have some, they would have disorders that really would represent internalized aggression. And that came from some other studies in the literature. We looked at 92 adolescent girls. They were all hospitalized for depression. So that, again, this is a clinical sample. Ages 11 to 18, most of the girls were 13 and a half to 14. And we hypothesized that different types of maltreatment and multiple forms of maltreatment, in other words, both a multiple risk and a cumulative risk model might apply here. And so we looked at them in that context. We divided them into four groups for one set of analyses. We had girls with no evidence of abuse, girls who had been physically abused and neglected, sexual abuse only, and multiple forms of abuse, sexual and physical abuse. And we also looked at a weighted composite of severity, frequency, and the number of independent episodes of abuse to weight each girl's abuse experience to look at impact. Again, as I said, age was, I guess the mean was 13, the median is about, I mean, the mean is 15, the median is about 13 and a half. Average IQ, we didn't look to see any girls whose IQ were below borderline. Most of these were Anglo girls. And there were no differences in these four groups on any of these characteristics except SES. The non-abused girls had a little higher SES, and the physically abused girls had the lowest SES. So the sexually abused girls fell in the middle. We used the self and relationship interview, and we looked at where we asked the girls about their real self, their relationship with mother, father, romantic friend, and best friend. And this is just what one of the bullseyes looks like from the self and relationship. So when we're talking about the core, we're talking about all the relationships that the girls put in the middle, and they would then tell us about the valence of that relationship. Was it positive, negative, or mixed? Just briefly to show you what we found. Here again, this is the percentage of the average percentage of positive self-perceptions in each of the four groups of girls. And you can see the blue line really has to, that's the core self. And you can see for most, for the girls saw themselves as more positive than negative. The positive attribution bias is alive and well. But what you can see is that there are fewer positive attributions to relationships and to self in the group number four, the sexually abused girls there at the far end who also were physically abused. Here are their patterns of negativity. And interestingly enough, the non-abused girls, now these are all depressed, all right, so they're supposed to feel something more negative. But, and again, the blue lines are core self, middle of that diagram, and the relationships that are least important to the girls are the yellow lines. And you can see the non-abused girls saw the most negativity in the relationships that were the least important to them. Whereas if you take a look at the last two groups, the sexually abused groups, there was a tremendous amount of negativity attributed in the core self. The physically abused girls in the middle here actually saw the most negativity in both those relationships that were moderately important to them in the middle and those in the outer groups. And so we really did find some differences in their negative attributions. What does this mean? We were trying to understand what would be most predictive of really seeing your core self as negative. And we found in a multivariate model that the only thing that predicted negative core self was sexual abuse. It wasn't age, it wasn't IQ, it wasn't physical abuse, it wasn't depression, it wasn't a host of diagnoses that we looked at. It was sexual abuse. And it accounted, again, we had an R-square of 0.30. We looked at diagnostic identifications. We asked then again, what is it? Are there a unique constellation of diagnostic symptoms that we see in sexually abused girls? And we found that these five, suicide attempts, self-mutilation, substance abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, and borderline personality disorder were the four that seemed to uniquely predict sexual abuse from the other, from physical abuse or from no abuse. And again, just to show you what self-mutilation looks like, non-abused, physically abused, sexually abused, and sexually and physically abused. And you can see we saw some self-mutilation in the non-abused group, but most of it in the physically abused group. And again, borderline personality disorder, which is a basic, is a personality disorder that really tells us about splitting. There were no girls with diagnosed personality disorder in the physically abused group, very few in the non-abused group, and again, most of them we found in groups 3 and 4. Physically abused girls did have some post-traumatic stress, although it was only 12% of that group as opposed to 77% of the group of girls with both sexual and physical abuse. But we also found that uniquely, the physically abused girls had diagnoses of attention deficit disorder, which was very puzzling. Skip PTSD and just end with only the groups of girls in which physical abuse had occurred did we find attention deficit disorder. And I'll leave you with this question. What in the world does this mean? We really would love some ideas and some help. Any last thoughts, and then I'll end. Why in the world would physically abused girls uniquely present with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as adolescents? Yes.
I wonder if maybe some of the way that ADHD presents itself might provoke an abuser or someone who is potentially an abuser to go ahead with it.
Yeah. So maybe they were more vulnerable. That I think that's a reasonable hypothesis.
I think also the symptomology of ADHD is you can easily, in my experience, misdiagnose somebody as ADHD just because the symptoms of something else may fit very easily into the criteria. So they may be presenting with symptomology of physical abuse, and it's more easily labeled as ADHD, whereas if you know that a child has sexual abuse, you might be more likely to look at another another diagnosis.
And we know that complex PTSD is often mislabeled for attention deficit disorder, but the question is this a variant, for example, of post-traumatic stress disorder that really includes attention deficit hyperactivity and concentration that may be a particular direct response? So that, you know. Any other thoughts?
With the increase of abuse, you have probably an increase of cortisol levels and different kind of hormonal stress, fight or flight response, inflammation of the amygdala. In translation to, you know, competence testing and stuff like that, ADHD, the ability to self-regulate, hyperactivity and stuff like that, you're going to always have that hypervigilance, the hypertension that goes along with those. I'm not really a big fan of this ADHD thing. I think that it could be all sorts of different things, but definitely one of the prevalence of being in a stress-filled environment, that's definitely the consequences. But otherwise, it could be just, certain people's temperament and, you know, emotional, responsiveness and sensitivities and stuff like that, different foods they eat, and also just different personality behaviors could also lead to it. But the positive correlation between that and physical abuse, I think, has something to do with what the stress hormones and the hypervigilance and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think that's another very good argument. The place we're really going to get in trouble is, so why don't the sexually abused girls also have ADHD? And again, it may be a variant in the presentation. So, but it certainly feels more like differences rather than similarities, even in some ways we hadn't expected.
Anyway,
thank you all.
Thank you very much.